programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting Shakespeare's King John with seven other productions through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
You're listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That on the Zesty Garden. In studio with me is Jerry Goodspeed, USU Horticulture Extension Agent, and we're going to talk about comfrey. Now, I have a comfrey plant. I didn't know what it was until I had someone identify it for me. I noticed that the bumblebees absolutely love this plant.
Yes, they do.
One thing I've noticed that it does do, once it gets up big and tall, it likes to just flop over.
Yep.
So then I have to put something around it, and my wife tells me it's really good for to have a comfrey bath, and I just don't even want to go that far, but dry the leaves out.
So I wondered what people use comfrey for. Now I know.
Now you know. I guess you take you dry the leaves and put it into the bath, and... And
maybe I didn't want to know.
I don't want to know where all the little pieces of the leaves go and where they end up. So I just have avoided doing that. So, but the comfrey plant, mine grows probably
pretty good size.
About 4.5
feet
tall.
If it didn't flop, it would get that tall.
Yeah. But it's got these beautiful purple little flowers, and like the bumblebees are all over it. So I keep it for that.
Yep.
But I have noticed in the last couple of years, I went, wait a minute, where did that comfrey plant come from? I did not plant that. And mine's in a bucket. Somebody before us who had the house had put it in a bucket.
Somebody was smart.
And I'm thinking they must have known what they were doing because...
My experience with comfrey was back on the coast when we first planted it and we put it out into our garden. And after a year or so, we noticed that it was multiplying and growing. And so I decided, well, I'll just till this up and get rid of it.
Oops.
Yeah. I tilled it up, and all of a sudden I had a garden of comfrey. Because everywhere where those little rhizomes or those little roots, if you will, were, I had new plants. And so then I was trying to get rid of it other ways, and it was very difficult to get rid of. And that's one of the problems with comfrey. How you have it planted is the perfect way. Plant it in a bucket. Plant it in a way where if you're going to use it for your bath, then you can just go out on a Saturday night. I don't know when you bathe, but go out on a Saturday night, take a couple leaves, I guess, and...
Wear a bathrobe, please.
Yes. That's required.
Well, okay, so this, I should describe it a little bit more, too. It's a fairly compact growing plant. Long green leaves that are on it. They look really nice. The grasshoppers adore this plant. I don't know.
Maybe that's another reason not to plant it.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I keep this one plant kind of going along and use it as an attractant for the grasshoppers to keep them off my raspberries. That doesn't seem to be working too well.
It just gives them a little herb to add with their raspberries as they go back and forth, you see.
So what else would you use this plant for?
That's the other reason why, wait, don't plant that. Why are you planting it? I mean, what? And that's what I tell a lot of people. Decide why you're planting it. Now, if you're planting it for medicinal reasons or for culinary reasons or for bathing reasons, whatever it is, well, that's a reason. And then you know what you're planting it for. But I've had a couple of people that have grown comfrey, and I went and I said, so why are you growing comfrey? And they said, well, I read somewhere in a book that it's supposed to be good. Good for what? So, and they had a hard time answering that.
So my reason the reason I keep it is bumblebees.
I like to see the
bumblebees using it, and so that's a
perfect
great reason.
As
long as it's in the bucket,
in
not
the bucket.
Spreading.
Keep it in the bucket.
Keep it in the bucket.
Yep.
Well, that's our we don't call it a weed, or would you call it a weed?
People call it an herb, but usually what I call an herb is just a weed that we can't get rid of, so we call it an herb because that way we can justify keeping it.
So I guess basically anything that you've got that you don't want is going to be called
a weed. It's
going
to be called a weed, yeah. Planted in the wrong place.
Today's weed du jour is comfrey. Don't plant it.
Yes.
Unless you put it in a bucket.
Correct.
And you've been listening to Jerry Goodspeed, USU Horticulture Extension Agent, with the Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment. And our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That plant was comfrey. Jerry, thanks for coming in. Coming up next on the Zesty Garden, it's our Petals and Prose segment with Helen Cannon, a former teacher of English at USU, Logan resident, and a lover of gardens and literature. And her readings of Colette, the French writer, and her writings about oranges.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I wanted to begin by paying tribute to one of the finest gardeners I've known and one of the finest men I've known as well, Will Pitkin. Will loved gardening. He had marvelous shallots and garlic, and he was so glad always to share what he had grown. We've lost Will, and it's a great loss to all those who loved Will and all those who loved gardening. I wanted to tell a little bit about what goes into my selections for this program. I wanted to read something from Colette, the marvelous French writer, her memory of oranges and orange groves. And I could not find it. I went on a frantic search, looked through dozens of my Colette books, both in French and in English, and I couldn't find it. But one day, out of one of the books, fell a paper written by one of my students. I had used Colette in a class, and the paper is so wonderful. I wish very fervently that I could find this student and thank her. She calls it Colette's Truth. I'm eating an orange. I've been doing that with more frequency lately. With each bite, the orange bursts sweet citrus juices to my cheeks and along my teeth. I hold my tongue to the roof of my mouth, capturing the flavor for as long as I can. My fingernails are filled with white orange pulp. My hands are sticky and fruity. I close my eyes, absorbing the experience of this fruit, and catch myself wondering why I savor it so. Ah, yes, I think. A writer reminded me to enjoy this moment. I heard her words, and orange eating has forever changed. My hands are full of orange, and so my elbow holds the book open while reading stories Colette told about her life. I revel in her keen observations, the details in her writings that place me where I've never been and help me experience a world I can never know. Each incident brings me some truth, an idea I've possibly always known but never expressed or even consciously realized. I close the book, careful not to let the juices of my orange fall on its pages. I take in the last orange slice and lick my fingers one by one, and I begin to think about how to describe this moment. I realize that already my mind has forgotten some details, that my experience, as I remember it, is probably not exactly as it happened. Instead, I am remembering my own happy version of orange eating, and for me, it was a moment of truth. And Colette invented the truth as well. On the back of the student paper, I found the page number and the book where I could find the passage on oranges. And there's another little story I'll tell first. It's a wager that I made that was a sure bet. I and my family were traveling to southern Utah, and I was reading this passage and crying. And I stopped and said, I'll bet this is the only car in the universe where the mother is reading a Colette passage on oranges and crying. This is the passage. When there were oranges, ever since we've been without them, the name alone is enough to set flowing in our deprived mouths the clear saliva that greets a freshly cut lemon, raw sorrel, or peppery pimpernel. I interrupt myself to say that at this point, Colette was terribly crippled with arthritis. She couldn't visit the orange groves nor the market stalls. Furthermore, it was just after the First World War, and the oranges were not plentiful then, were not available as they had been. So she has to reinvent oranges in her own mind. But our need for oranges goes beyond craving. We want to see oranges too. We think of that reflection, that footlight, which rose up from the heavily laden carts to the faces leaning over them in the street. We want to buy one, or two, or 10 kilos of oranges. We want to feel their weight, to carry off those cut branches, bearers of glossy leaves, and the mandarins that blaze in the stalls of Corsalea in Nice, all along in the flower market. We feel a terrible longing for those round baskets which perfumed our hotel room, which we would send to our friends in Paris. The woman who sold them to us would throw in beneath the cover a bunch of violets and a sprig of mimosa. These little memories, bittersweet, exasperating, they seem so real that we are left feeling somewhat craven. There were also those tiny local mandarins puffed out around their equator, which under your nail exuded an abundance of essential oil through their pores. There were the excellent Italian delicacies made of muscat grapes preserved in syrupy wine, shriveled in the sun, mummified and heady. Will I be reproached for not bringing up, not without cruelty, a rather painful subject? I protest that for some time now we've been trained to face wartime shortages squarely and unflinchingly. It's a good form of mental exercise. Moreover, many a one who doesn't bat an eye at the sight of a bar of chocolate weakens at the mere thought of a fresh orange still wearing a little leaf on its stem. I confess, I am such a one, an orange, but not just any orange. Westerners have yet to be educated. Listen to them ordering in a restaurant, "I'll have an orange," as if there were only one kind in all the world, one crop, one tree, one indistinct multitude of oranges. The fruit, room temperature, the water in the glass cold, that is how water and fruit seem best. What is one to make of the fruit that is removed like a cooling planet from the warmth that formed it? An apricot picked and eaten in the sun is sublime. The hour I spend in Moroccan orange groves is alive in my memory and in my gratitude, as if still I had the yellow line under my nails, left by a glut of the ripest oranges, dark, smallish, with a cheek sometimes rubbed with bright red rouge. Marrakesh gave us still more, pure water, roses, nightingales, that at a given nocturnal sign would all break into song at once. Onrushing dawns that would invade the sky like a conflagration, and oranges on orange trees, opulent orange groves of a master once discriminating and lavish, the secret alignment on what at first approach appears provocatively random, but what pains produced and protected such harvests, their fragrance falling from above, trailed across the ground and nearly barred our passage. Waxy petals fell in a steady rain, carrying the drunken bees along with them as they fell. The bees hit the ground with them, got up, covered with dust, found their way back into the blossoms hanging among the fruit. In its turn, an orange would fall, a big, heavy, egg-shaped orange that split as it hit the ground and bled pink blood from its fall. Not far off, the pink walls of the city against the sky already bleached by the heat enclosed this paradise. A well-guarded paradise it was. If I raised a hand toward its golden fruit, the sinewy black arm of the Moroccan angel would burst through the leaves, brandishing a stick. A word from our guide and the bronze arm, swallowed back up for a moment, reappeared its dark palm, tendering a juicy orange. A hot city grafts onto us memories of an earlier time, memories dearer than the plentiful waters that enrich it, reflect its sky, keep its trees green, swell its fruit, and play with the sands. Like a silver nail, many are the fountains that fix the image of a garden I have loved. For how many years did I stop, once each year at Aix-en-Provence, on the way from Paris to Saint-Tropez, because of a spring that has been rushing from a fountain for 1,000 years. I would dip my cup in the ancient waters, imitating the spring's devotees, the old woman with her carafe, the boy with his jug, the little brown-haired girl with her umbilicate pitcher. I would drink deeply from the fresh, sweet waters of Aix. The Roman fountain is a link in my desires every time I saw water in a confined place well up. A garden without a spring does not murmur enough, and my longings have yet to be cut from the living waters of my childhood, surging up from my native soil in a small flood, no sooner born than lost, known to the shepherd, tramps, hunting dogs, the fox, and the bird. I wanted spring in my garden. I want one still, though I no longer have a garden. And the one in the Palais Royal has had no water since the war began. Some tangible glass paperweights in whose centers is a twisted frozen frenzy of hard-cracked sugars, flowers, and bacteria, like the oat grain that have feelers like a shrimp and which, testing the air and turning this way and that, produce good or bad weather. But I have more than movables. I have exclusive possession of nearly everything I have lost, even my dear departed ones, in which regard I resemble a little trout-colored horse I drove on one summer long ago. On a road in Picardy, he came across a harrow standing idle during the farmer's siesta. The little trout-colored horse, a Parisian, lost his composure so utterly, wheeling around, shying back, lowering his head between his forelegs, arching his back like a mermaid, that nothing could prevail upon him or reassure him. Fright aside, I have been that visionary little horse. Life is hard-pressed to dispossess me. I shall never stop going over what chance has made mine. I am still at it, while my oldest friend has preferred the unintelligible repose of the dead to the quiet company of his books, his favorite armchair and his cat. I am still at it, as I gaze past his brown Bernese face to the celestial horizon, the small flat earth one discovers high up in a free balloon, and I inventory the instruments thrown pell-mell into a gigantic picnic basket that is lighter than aircraft. So this is my passage, or at least parts of it, that I was frantic to find. I hope you take pleasure. I hope you find a beautiful orange, maybe a blood orange, the orange sanguine, just to make it different from an ordinary orange. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Cracks in tree trunks, stunted leaf growth, and thin canopies are all signs your tree is struggling. Diagnosing the cause of the symptoms is the first step in improving your tree's health. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Several factors can cause bark on trees to crack and peel. Trees planted too deep and pruned with flush cuts are more subject to frost crack and sun scald. Girdling roots can also result in stunted growth and dieback on trees. These circling roots place pressure on the expanding trunk and stop the flow of water and nutrients between the roots and leaves. It is usually a flattened trunk, decline, or other above-ground symptom that indicates there is a problem below ground. Physical injury to the trunk or improper pruning can also result in poor wound closure. Proper care is about the only option at this point. Make sure the tree is properly watered and mulched to reduce further stress. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Intermountain Medical Group doctors Gary Harris and Bart Avery, welcoming Dr. David Amott to the new North Cache Valley Medical Clinic on Highway 91 in Hyde Park. Appointments being accepted at 563-4800.
I'm Brian Earle, and I'm in studio with David Wallace. He's on the board of the Utah Native Plant Society and is with Cache Hikers. And this week for Take a Hike, we're going to talk about yellow flax. Now, David, for me, flax brings to mind this a shrub of a flower. It gets a couple of feet high, and it's blue, and I see it along the roads. It's really drought tolerant. This is a yellow flax, and it doesn't look like it's quite as big, but it looks like a flax.
Yes, it is a true flax. The blue flax you mentioned is Linum lewisi. That's named after the Lewis and Clark expedition. And this one is called Linum kingii, named after another explorer named King. They're both members of the genus Linum, which means linen. I'll say that's the root of the word linen. You've heard of linseed oil and linoleum. Those are all products made from the flax plant, as well as, of course, the linen cloth. This yellow flax is one that only grows in our higher mountains. It's one that I've been able to enjoy for a few years. In fact, I recently opened up a plant guidebook I had on my bookshelf that I hadn't opened for many years, and there was a pressed flower of our yellow flax there in the middle. It was kind of an interesting find because I'd forgotten all about it. Anyway, this yellow flax, once again, it's a high mountain plant. It's not nearly as tall as the blue one that you remember. It's only about 6 inches or so. But the good thing is it grows right along the trail if you're hiking from Tony Grove towards Mount Naomi.
And it is a true yellow.
It is, yeah, a true yellow. Mm-hmm.
Do you see a lot of it together? Is it going to be up against the rocks? I'm assuming because blue flax like to have good drainage, this is going to be in an area that wants really good drainage.
Yeah, well, you'll actually see some of the blue flax as you approach.
Okay.
But this plant is found in the drier, rockier areas along the trail. You can find it growing right against rocks, and usually when you find it, there's more around. So just keep your eyes open. Maybe the first 3/4 of a mile as you're hiking up towards the peak.
You start off at Tony Grove Lake, Logan Canyon, and you're going to take the right trail out of the three. And then how far along the trail do you go before it splits off to the Mount Naomi?
Okay, we've talked about how to get to Tony Grove Lake before. The trail starts at the west end of the Tony Grove parking lot. Park there and pay your $6 fee. When you start at the trail, head to the north for about a quarter mile. This is the trail that goes to White Pine Lake and Naomi Peak, Mount Naomi. There'll be a fork in the trail at this point after about a quarter mile, and you'll take the left-hand fork heading toward the west.
And there's a sign.
There's a sign
that says
there.
Naomi Peak.
Yep.
So
the trail is well-defined and fairly heavily used, so there will be no problem with that.
And Naomi Peak is the tallest peak?
It's the tallest
peak.
In Cache
County?
Yes, the tallest peak in the Bear River Range. It's 9,800 feet, I believe. That sounds short for our people from Salt Lake City, but it's pretty tall for us up here. If you were to go all the way to the peak, it'd be a decent climb. You start around 8,100 feet at the lake and then end up there at 98 at the peak. It's actually not only a well-maintained trail, but a well-known trail. It's on the National Register. Its full name of the trail is the Mount Naomi Peak National Recreation Trail, or NRT.
And how long would you give for this hike? I know I ask every week, and it depends on how much you stop and look, but if you were just walking at a gentle pace.
Oh, I'd say 3 or 4 hours.
Okay, so plan on at least.
If you're going all the way to the peak, because it's about 3.5 miles each way, so you're talking about a 7-mile trip, and most of us hike around 1.5 miles per hour. So give yourself some extra time.
And always remember to take extra water. It's like every hike I've been on, even if I'm in the top of the mountains, take that extra water.
Yes, it's always a good idea to do that. On this trail, you are likely to find some water. There's a place where water is usually found. And if you're earlier in the year, you can find snow on the top. But for now, it's fairly dry.
And what else will we see along the trail? I notice you've got listed here the quartzite stairs north of Tony Grove.
Let's go back to the fork in the trail where you head towards Mount Naomi from White Pine. After about 1/2 mile from there, you'll come to an open, rocky area. And on your left, if you look back towards Tony Grove, you'll see some quartzite stairs. It's really kind of interesting. They're called the stairs. If you were to go to Wikipedia and look up quartzite, you'll see that exact picture of the stairs.
Oh, okay.
is an excellent example of that rock formation. And also in that same area, in fact, before you get to where you see the stairs, you're likely to find the yellow flax. And it growing with it are some other plants. I thought I'd mention this one especially because at first glance it looks similar. About the same height and the same color as our yellow flax would be our stone crop. Stone crop is a sedum. Sedums are common plants of rock gardens, for example. This is a wild one called Sedum debili. This stone crop is maybe 6 inches tall and about the same height as the flax. And like I say, growing similar locations. And at first glance, you might not notice that it's two different species.
David, thank you very much. So we've been talking about yellow flax available along the Mount Naomi Trail that takes off from the White Pine Trail, which takes off from Tony Grove. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Take a Hike. David Wallace is on the board of Utah Native Plant Society and with the Cache Hikers. In our gardening calendar, Washash Community Gardens in Salt Lake is hosting a course on fall planting on this Saturday from 10 to noon at the Grateful Tomato Garden, 800 South, 600 East in Salt Lake. Registration is required. Details are online at wasatchgardens.org. USU Extension is hosting a course on harvesting rainwater this Saturday at 9 a.m. at the Iron County Visitor Center, 581 North Main in Cedar City. This course will provide an overview of rainwater harvesting, history, uses, and applicability to conserving rainfall as a natural resource. Information is at 435-586-8132. The Ogden Botanical Gardens will host a diagnostic clinic Wednesday, August 7th from 3 to 6. Master Gardeners will help you solve problems with trees and shrubs, lawns, vegetables, or flower gardens. Ogden Botanical Gardens is located at 1750 Monroe Boulevard. And then Thanksgiving Point is hosting a class on propagation by cutting on Saturday, September 7th at 9 a.m. Discover how easy it is to propagate plants. It's a great way to add your plant collection, to add to it for very little money. Information is at thanksgivingpoint.com. And then finally, the City of Price is hosting the High Desert Growers Farmers Market Saturdays from 9 to noon at Main Street and 100 East. And the Escalante Farmers Market is held Saturdays from 9 to noon at the corner of Main Street and Center Street. For the last part of the program, I have in studio with me Mike Coons. He's USU's Extension Forestry Specialist, and we're going to talk about how to make your landscape more fire-wise. Now, Mike, one of the first things that I would think of is, does every homeowner have to, should they worry about this?
No. In general, no. And I wonder about that. When a fire comes, there's often a little bit of panic, and we've had fires, for example, in the Logan area up on Saddle Mountain right to the east of town, maybe three or four times since I've lived here in 21 years. And a couple of times those burned down close to homes that have, of course, crept up the hill a little bit. And those people should be concerned, the ones that are right next to the wildland. Or even if it's not wildland, if they are just – and this is common in the Salt Lake County, well, really Weber all the way down to Utah County, where the oak and maple, scrubby oak and maple that's native, comes down into the edges of the city, and the city has built up into those scrubby oaks and maples, they should be concerned. Those people should be concerned.
Because the fire will follow those avenues of oak.
Right. Anybody out, like there's all sorts of wildland subdivisions where people have just a summer home, you know, up all of our canyons down in southern Utah. A classic place is Duck Creek, which is Duck Creek is up in the high forest, you know, up in the spruce and fir, and those people should be concerned. Look around you, and anything that can burn, think of it as fuel, including your home, and also your deck and a wooden fence and things like that. But then, of course, the vegetation that's around it. And the more fuel you have and the nearer it is to your home, the more you should be concerned.
Now, there's nothing there's no such thing as fireproof vegetation.
Right.
Everything will burn.
Right. Even an ice plant in a really severe situation, or hen and chicks or something, will burn if things are hot enough. The nice thing about plants like that is they're not going to contribute a lot of heat to the fire. So succulents, non-resinous plants, plants that are green during the fire season, which for us typically the fire season starts in, you know, we think of it really getting going in July and going until September maybe, and occasionally earlier and later, but that's the core of it. And so you'd like plants that are green and moist during that time, or plants that, if they're not green and moist during that time, small stature plants are good, so things that don't get really big, which means trees, by their nature, are not very firewise. And in the recommendations we make, on our website, we recommend spacing trees out away from the home, but also away from each other in the near part of the landscape near the home.
Okay, now here's the difficult part. usually you're building a home in an area like that because you like to have the vegetation to obscure your home. I've been in a couple of subdivisions in Sandy, for instance, and those scrub oaks are completely in the neighborhood. They're part of the neighborhood. You basically see the rooftops of the homes.
Right. Yeah, and that's not very safe. And if you want to be sure that your home doesn't burn up in a fire, then you're going to need to do some reduction of that vegetation, especially in the first 30 feet away from the home and to a lesser extent out to about 100 feet. And then beyond that, really, there's not a lot that needs to be done. 30 feet, most people who live in those areas probably control 30 feet. They may not if they have a near neighbor to the side. But 100 feet, lots of times they don't control that. You know, the 100 feet is in the neighbor's yard or even in the wildland, maybe, Forest Service. And that's where you have to work with your neighbors to do the vegetation control needed.
See, hard because you have some of these lots that are only even at the most a third of an acre, usually a quarter of an acre or under. So.
Yeah, and if you have a home where most of your landscape is within 30 to 60 feet of the home, if you want to be safe, you can't have that kind of vegetation near your home. If you know, a lot of us would find attractive a photograph I've got of a home set back in the oak, and the oak actually kind of arches over the driveway, and you drive through this tunnel of a driveway, and you show up back at your house, and maybe it's a little more clear around the home. Well, a fire department probably shouldn't, whether they would or not, I'm not sure, but probably shouldn't be going down that driveway if there's a fire coming, because they may not get out because they may be trapped. And also, as they come to a neighborhood with a fire approaching, they may have to make some triage decisions. That's a little pun, triage.
Got it.
they may have to make some decisions which homes or what part of the neighborhood to set up and take a stand, and other parts of the neighborhood to not try to protect. And the ones they won't try to protect are the ones that are too dangerous for them to be there. Now, they may the use of air resources, helicopters and tankers, is really skyrocketed, it seems to me, in the last 20 years or so. And so they may bring in a tanker and do a drop, and that may help. But the persons on the fire that are on the ground shouldn't go into those dangerous areas. And I've heard, I haven't seen photographs of this, that the Hayman Fire, I think it was, southwest of Denver, a number of years ago, that burned lots of homes. And it seems like it was maybe Colorado's first big fire in a while that burned lots of homes. That there were cases where the fire department came through ahead of time and painted big red X's on houses that could be seen from a distance so that the firefighting people would know we're not trying to save this one. And the type of house they wouldn't try to save if they're pressed, you know, if they don't have enough people or resources, or it's a hot, really fast-moving fire and dangerous, are homes that, number one, if they have a wood roof. So that's where, when I think of Logan here where I live, and I think, should anybody away from the edge of the national forest be concerned, you know, where you really don't have oak, maple, and maple around you, you don't have junipers, if you have a wood roof and you're within, you know, a quarter mile, half mile, even a little more of where a wildfire might occur, you may end up with burning embers landing on your roof. In really severe fires, you can get embers going several miles ahead of the fire, and the fire jumps that way. And so a wood roof is a house that isn't very protectable, poorly maintained, so lots piles of pine needles in the gutters and in the valleys on the roof, and then lots of vegetation right up to the home. And conifers are worse than most broadleaves because of the resins that most of them contain. And then just the zoning of the landscape. So if you're just perched right in there in the middle of the oak, and the oak is, you know, 2 feet from your windows, then you're at high risk. And
so is there anything to show, any studies that have shown that, because when you see a fire that goes through an area, there'll be houses every once in a while that are just fine and didn't get touched. Is there anything to show that those homes had better fire prevention as far as their vegetation around them?
Yeah. It's a little hard to pick it out sometimes because sometimes the fire department just does make a heroic stand someplace that maybe they shouldn't because they're putting themselves in danger. But I looked at a couple of homes that survived. I can't remember what they called the fire, but it was in Harriman. Seems like it was last year. There have been a couple up there recently. But and I went up this long street that kind of dead ends up against, I think it's Camp Williams, actually, National Guard.
And isn't that where the fire came from, was Camp Williams?
Yeah. And there was a home that was surrounded by homes that had burned, and this one didn't. And I'm not the expert that – there's a guy, Jack Cohen, with the Forest Service, who actually goes in and systematically assesses landscapes and homes and how did – why did this one burn and this one didn't. And I'm not the expert he is, but pavement – a placement of pavement was really important. They had, a paved driveway, paved sidewalk near one side of the house. Then they had a gravel pad around the side of the house and in the back of the house for parking of maybe they had an RV and a couple of vehicles. And then beyond that, there was a horse pasture that had almost nothing left in it. They, I think, mainly fed the horses with hay. And so they had lots of clear space around them. They did have a fair amount of dense vegetation on one side of the house. And in that regard, maybe they were just lucky. But all around the house, maybe three-fourths of the way around the house, they had in just because they had a horse and they had some RVs and you could see where embers had landed on the gravel pad, and like an ember, like maybe a 2-3 inch piece of a branch that was burning when it blew in on the wind, and landed on the gravel pad or out in the horse pasture, and just burned up and didn't burn anything. But if that had landed on pine needles under an Austrian pine, 5 feet or 10 feet from the house, with the branches hanging over the house, add to that maybe a wood roof, and you've got a house that burns down.
Is there anything to show from insurers? I mean, are they looking at, okay, what area do you live in, and are you more fire prone? And if you are, we're going to charge you more.
I don't know the current status of that in Utah, but insurance companies certainly – where they've taken big losses in Colorado and California, have paid attention to this. My understanding of insurance and how the law handles it is they can assign a class of homes maybe in a certain area or that are built a certain way to a higher risk category and charge them more only if they can actually do the mathematical modeling to prove that these homes are at more risk and it's this much more risk and therefore we need to charge them this much more so we don't go broke. a state farm in Utah a number of years ago was sending an inspector around, and every property out in the wildlands that State Farm was insuring would be inspected, and the inspector, and it was a contractor, and the inspector would say, you need to do this, this, and this, and they had some amount of time to do that, and if they didn't, State Farm wasn't going to insure them anymore. So they weren't going to raise the rates. They were just not going to insure them. I heard of that starting up and haven't really heard recently what's going on with that, but certainly insurers where they're willing, it's expensive for them to prove what they need to prove. But
as our climate becomes drier and warmer, that incentive is going to kick up because they're going to start getting more losses. And so
– Yeah. And, of course, this is mostly a concern where you've got homes out there in the wildlands. And we're not in as much risk as like the chaparral fire type in California, where it's plants that have substances in the plant that make them burn really hot and fast, and the plants sprout from their roots and get big quick, so you have a lot of biomass building up quick that can burn, and a lot of homes right in amongst all that. We don't have as much of that in Utah, but some places we have plenty of it. And those are the places where occasionally we lose a few homes. The oak maple type isn't quite as bad as like that chaparral type, but it'll firefighter got killed and several homes burned a number of years ago down by Wasatch. I can't remember the name of the state park in near Heber City, up above Heber City in the oak. And it seems like the oak maple is where we have the most concern because that's on the edges of these valley-located cities. But we do have places like Park City where people are living in amongst the big conifers. And, of course, as you say, they don't want to cut them down. They moved there for that look, and they may have even planted more after the construction was done to kind of close it in.
And Park City is one of those places that has had devastating fires. Now, it's been a long time ago when, and a lot of the structures were made of wood, but there's also a lot more people that are living in that area. So.
Right. Yeah, and the fact the home is made of wood doesn't matter so much except the wood roof. And, of course, the studs in the walls, that doesn't matter at all. Wood siding is certainly more flammable than certain other sidings. But I mentioned Jack Cohen earlier. He did a study up in northern Canada where a bunch of fire people got together and burned a spruce forest and surrounded it with a fire line so it couldn't possibly get out of control. And then they did lots of experiments all at once, all the way around this fire. And Jack Cohen did some mock-up houses and house walls. And this is where the 100-foot ideal that I mentioned comes from, because he found that you really couldn't get a house to burn if it was 100 feet or more from a fire on the flat. And this is a hot, raging crown fire. At about 60 feet or so, you got some charring and some plastic pieces fell out of some windows. And then as you got closer than that, it was more and more sure that the home was going to ignite just from the radiant heat from the nearby fire.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and Mike Coons is USU's Extension Forestry Specialist. He's in studio for the next 10 minutes, and if you'd like to get in a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1499. 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. We're talking about how to make your landscape so that it can survive more easily a fire. You can also post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page if you have a comment or question. And you can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So let's talk about what you term a defensible space and mm-hmm. those particular zones. And this would work for new homes being built or retrofitting your landscape.
Right.
As such. Now, you said three different zones that you're looking at. And so the first one, would you look at the one immediately adjacent to the house?
Right. And
or your structure?
We just call that the near area. And you can think of it as being about 30 feet, the first 30 feet, including the home itself. So you do the right things with the home, like not have a wood roof, don't allow pine needles and things to accumulate on the roof. You also then have a really close area as part of that, the 2 or 3 feet that is just non-flammable. And the best way to do it is if you have a patio, pavers or cement or whatever, or a sidewalk that's going to be located, well, just put it next to the house. Or a driveway. If you're going to have vegetation, you use the best vegetation we list in this publication. We'll mention that is going to be green and low, small, succulent, and just it would be really hard to burn it. And you maintain that really well. And then for the out to about 30 feet, you can have a few trees, but they should be
low-growing?
Well, not necessarily low-growing. You don't want a big tree hanging over the house. And if you have trees, you would like them to be to where the edges of the crowns, you know, the crown of foliage and branches, 10 feet between them so that they won't easily propagate a fire across the 30 feet to the house. You prune up the lower branches on the trees and try to get 15 feet maybe up from the ground so that we call that ladder fuels, where maybe a fire burns across the grass into a shrub and then from the shrub up into the crown of the tree. You'd like to break up that ladder by pruning and not having large shrubs under the trees. And this is where if you're going to have mowed irrigated grass, this would be the place to have it. Just things that are green and low in fuel and well-maintained. Then out from that, we go from 30 feet out to 100 feet. And that 30-foot to 100-foot plus that near zone together make what Cohen calls the home ignition zone. And that, he feels like if people would control that adequately, you can have the fire come, be ready for the evacuation, have your important papers and photographs with you, your computer hard drive maybe, and put it in the car and leave. And your home, because you did the right thing, things will take care of itself even if the fire people don't come. In that zone 30 to 100 feet, you kind of grade bit from that really well-manicured green landscape to the wildland, maybe clumps of trees with space between them.
And do you don't want to have a ladder, so you wouldn't necessarily start with short and then work toward taller. You still want to have separation.
Yeah, and if you're going to have shrubs, maybe you have a clump of shrubs but no tree nearby. And this is going to be the tough zone for a lot of people because it's in your neighbor's yard. and you're going to have to get along with your neighbors if you're going to be safe. In Southern California, they don't mess around. If your landscape isn't safe, the problem is it's not just going to burn your house and they could say, hey, we'll let – you know, if you're not going to do things safe, we'll let it burn your home. The problem is it makes it much more likely it's going to burn your neighbor's home as well. So what they do there is they go in and do the clearance that they've told you you needed to do and you didn't get around to it. And then it's added to your property tax and for that year. And obviously, we'd much rather people just take care of things on their own and get with their neighbors so that their neighbors are taking care of things. Some communities on the edges of wildlands have actually gotten together and rent a chipper truck on a weekend, and people thin the vegetation and remove vegetation and take it and chip it, and the chips are taken away and kind of get together as a community. There's actually a movement called Firewise Communities that encourages that, and the state forestry agency and fire departments work together to promote that.
Now, some of the fires that have taken place have been started by, I don't know, hawks or owls sitting on the utility poles. So is there a movement in these communities to make sure that these lines are buried? Because for the utility companies, they want to put these in at the cheapest cost, and that's putting a pole up. They don't want to necessarily bury them.
Right.
And there's going to be extra cost in that.
Well, two of the fires that burned on Saddle Mountain above Logan started with a large raptor flying between lines and contacting both, or it arcing, and then they died and fell to the ground.
And they're flaming when they hit the ground, yeah.
And the fire started at that point and burned up. In Logan, I remember that being talked about at the time because the lines were owned by the city of Logan, and the wires just weren't far enough apart. So they didn't need to bury the lines. They just needed to put them farther apart. And it was an older design, and the Rocky Mountain Power lines that were parallel to those were a newer design, and the lines were farther apart, and it hasn't happened with those.
I've also seen the triangles that get put on the cross posts to keep raptors from sitting there.
Oh, just from sitting there,
yeah.
I don't know that many lines are getting buried for that reason. One thing that
maybe
does
new subdivisions,
right? One thing that does happen though is in large fires, exposed power lines often arc and go down, and then the electricity isn't available, which may be needed to work pumps that somebody assumed they were going to use. Maybe they have a pond out back and they were going to use a pump to pump water if a fire came, and they can't do it.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and Mike Coons is USU's Extension Forestry Specialist. And we'll have a list and a link to different plants that would be good to use to have a Firewise landscape on our website a little bit later today. Thank you for joining us on the program. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2 with a changing menu of specialty salads, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.